Today, as we continue our series of study on the God who is there, I'm reminded of a couple of things. First of all, as I've often mentioned to you before, I find the titles to my series, whether they're important to you or not, they're important to me that I name the things I'm doing. I find the titles from a lot of different places. Now, this particular title, The God Who Is There, came when I first found a book at our Christian bookstore up there in Lubbock that was entitled The God Who Is There. Interestingly enough, the book was not on the subject of whether or not God exists, but rather focused more specifically on the idea that God has been involved in the history of mankind as recorded in the Bible, and that was the point of the author. But I was struck by that title. And then years and years ago, when I was first in the ministry, there was a popular writer at that time who since passed away, and you're not seeing his books as much anymore. But his name was Francis Schaeffer. He was both a minister in the Christian community, I think Presbyterian to be exact, but he had become quite a philosopher as well and took a leading role long before the days of some of our more modern apologists for the gospel like Josh McDowell or Lee Strobel in setting forth why we believe. And he wrote a book called He Is There and He Is Not Silent. And it was obviously a two-part book that talked about the existence of God and then the fact that the Bible is His revelation. So that's where we came up with the title, The God Who Is There, in talking about the existence of God. But I'm also reminded of the fact that when we talk about those who do not believe in God, there's actually two different categories of people. There is the group we're concerned about during this time, which I would call the intellectual atheist. That is, they have decided on the basis of their intellectual pursuits either that there is no God or at least there's not enough evidence to support that belief. And so they choose to be atheist. Atheist from the Greek word which means no God, atheos, or without God. But then there's another group of people which we're not primarily talking about. In fact, this other group is the people we're talking about most of the time other than now. And that's what I call the practical atheist. This is a person that if you were to ask them about if they believed in God, they would acknowledge they do. But there's absolutely nothing in their life that reflects that. They're the practical atheist. They profess to believe in God and then live as if He doesn't. But we're not talking about them right now. This intellectual atheism, because of the extreme influence it has in the scientific community and in the educational community of our culture, is making great inroads in our culture and beginning to try to eliminate belief in God and references to God and exposure to the idea that there is a God in every way possible. And they're doing a great job of it. We have to compliment them, I guess we would say, in that regard, because they have already succeeded in largely removing references to God, which would then expose people to the concept from our educational system, from our public schools, from our higher education and secondary colleges, universities. They've managed to intimidate a great number of people, at least in the scientific community, who still believe in God, but who would no longer openly profess that because some of their colleagues are so outspoken in ridiculing and making fun of them when they do confess they believe in God. They've demanded their civil rights and so had a lot of it removed from our public life, the political life of our country and the different things that go on in a public way. So they're doing a great job of pushing their agenda, frankly, much better than we are. But I'm not here even to advocate that we need to be more involved in the public arena in championing the cause of the believer, but rather to present to us evidences that support our reason for believing in Him. Now, I know none of us are in the category of the atheist, either practical or intellectual. But at the same time, we might feel intimidated when others challenge us, either directly or indirectly, about why we believe. And I want us to understand we have nothing to fear, but we do have something to do. We need to familiarize ourselves better than we ever have before about why we believe. That's important not only for our own faith, but to be able to answer those around us, as Peter would say, be ready always to give an answer to everyone that asks you a reason for the hope that is within you. But in our own families, they need to see that we have compelling reasons that we can express as to why we believe, because that will have a powerful effect long term upon our children, our grandchildren, and so forth. And those are the ones we're most concerned about. In 2007, a book was published called There Is a God: How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. Perhaps you remember at least some of the details surrounding this. The book was written by a man named Anthony Flew, considered in his time a great philosopher. He was British. He was highly respected in his field of study in a totally secular way. But he also championed the cause of atheism during most of his public life. He was a leading advocate of atheism and a scholarly critic of everything that had to do with both Christianity and the Muslim faith. He often ridiculed those who believed in these things, and because of his great intellect and very sharp way of thinking and very powerful way of expressing his point of view, often could make those who believe in God look pretty inept and ignorant. And yet something amazing happened. He changed his mind. In 2004, he shocked the academic and scientific world. Even though he was not a scientist, he often was the public face even of scientific atheism. He shocked his world when, in a radio interview, he announced in great detail his growing belief that the scientific evidence of design in the universe pointed to a powerful, intelligent designer. And he admitted that that's something he had not in the past been willing to entertain, because he had not up until that point found the arguments of theists, those who believed in God, he didn't find their arguments compelling. But as he continued to listen to those in the scientific community, those who were atheists, as they continued to describe and reveal the work they were doing in their fields of study, he became more and more persuaded that what they were describing could not be by chance. His pronouncement in 2004 on that radio program and subsequent interviews and writings and speeches and so forth by him finally led to the publication of his book in 2007. This created, of course, an immediate furor among all those who had looked up to him as their champion. Now, we need to be careful to say that he was not admitting that he believed that this God he's talking about was identical to the God described in the Bible. That does not mean that he believed that Jesus was a son of this God. This does not mean that he even believed in life after death, because he never was convinced of that, even at his death in 2010. But it does mean that he made a big step by moving from one side of the aisle over to the other in this whole discussion about whether or not there might be a supernatural being. It's very interesting to read what many of his critics had to say, who formerly were his colleagues. I see at least three different responses that have come in the years since he first made that pronouncement. It's been about 8 years now since he did that. Like I say, he passed away in 2010, and he didn't recant what he had said. Three different responses. Number one, many claim that at age 81, he obviously was in mental decline and was not the scholar that he once was, and that is the explanation for him going soft on this subject. Though there's absolutely no evidence that that was actually the case, and until the very day he made the announcement, no one thought he was in mental decline. Only after he made the announcement. Secondly, there's another group who claim that others were actually putting words in his mouth, and these were not actually his thought and his beliefs. He himself spent the rest of his life, from 2004 until his death, trying to put the lie to that by insisting over and over in public appearances and in his writings and finally in his book, saying that this is what I believe. Yes, others helped me in my understanding of it. And yes, my book, even in 2007, was written with the help of someone else. But they were my words. We went through four complete revisions of the whole thing until it said what I wanted it to say, not what someone else wanted it to say. But the third response has been a new outcry on that side, the atheistic side, of books and articles and public appearances in which they keep insisting that atheism is the only correct possible belief that real intellectual people will accept. But I want you to notice what it was that convinced him. We said over the last 2 weeks that when we talk about evidence for God, we're not talking about the kind of thing in which we can say, everybody look up and you'll see him. That would be knowing something. If everybody could see him, then it wouldn't be a matter of faith, and I'm not using faith as a crutch in place of knowing, but rather faith is simply believing in that which is unseen. The vast majority of what scientists, historians, and every other kind of professional believes is in the area of faith, not in sight. And so faith is not a bad thing. It's the common thing in most intellectual pursuits. But when you establish evidence enough to create faith, you usually have to have many evidences, arguments, logical reasonings, and so forth that all add up to the point where you say this is beyond a reasonable doubt. And the famous trial, which I don't want to even give credit to by even mentioning what it's about, but you know what I'm talking about, the trial that's been going on this past week nationally in which they finally found the man guilty Friday night. One of the jurors came out and said yesterday, the defense never created reasonable doubt. One juror says, the defense never could create, in that juror's mind at least, any doubt, reasonable doubt, that all the arguments and evidences being presented by the prosecution weren't true. And so we work in all sorts of areas with this idea of many different things being piled up on top of one another that bring us to a point where we say that's now beyond reasonable doubt for me. And for different people, it's maybe different things in particular that finally tips the scale. But the tipping of the scale does happen in all of our lives all the time about many different things. Well, it turned out for Mr. Flew, Dr. Flew, the thing that tipped the scales for him, and the one thing he said of all the different arguments and evidences that believers in God often present, the one thing that convinced him beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a God is the argument from design. Now, we talked last week about the argument about for God from creation or the existence of things. And this is a real challenge, of course, for those who don't believe in God because they have to find another alternative explanation for where everything came from. And by everything, we're talking about this whole universe and every atom in it. And the philosopher, this is where the philosopher steps into the equation and not just the scientist. The philosopher says there's only three possible explanations, and you have to settle on one. Either it came from nothing, or it has always existed, or some other something brought it into existence. The third possible explanation is what's called cause and effect. There has to be something that this is just the effect of this cause. But today we're talking not about why everything exists, but rather what this everything that exists looks like. And it's called the argument from design. The whole study of science ultimately is the study of design. The design of the heavens in the areas of astronomy and astrophysics. The study of the atom in nuclear physics. The study of life in biology. The study of design even in the rocks and in the earth's crust, in geology, and even those softer sciences that some choose not to even call sciences, studies of psychology and anthropology, in which they're actually studying design of the human mind, our human existence. And it's this argument that Flew said convinced him. And it's interesting because he basically indicated the argument was actually being made by people who didn't believe the conclusion. They kept telling him, and he kept seeing more and more through research that others were doing, that everything from the most minute, infinitesimal, invisible elements of our universe to the greatest, grandest portrait of the universe as a whole, every bit of it has design, order, arrangement about it. And any other explanation of how that all came to be was insufficient to explain it. This is the argument from design. Now, there's another part to this argument. We often just talk about the argument from design. Everything has order, arrangement about it. There's the laws of nature, as we often refer to them. And yet another part of this same argument, which we're not going to spend time on tonight or this morning, is evidence of purpose or reason for there being a design. In other words, why is the Earth's surface, at least the greater part of it, of just the right temperature with all the right components that supports life? A great concern over the last 30, 40 years is what we call global warming. Where the scientists are saying if the temperature worldwide just goes up 2 degrees, we face cataclysmic consequences. Well, how is it that the ecosphere that makes up our Earth's surface that we live in and depend on is so finely ordered and arranged and designed that it stays right within that very, very narrow temperature necessary to support life? And when there have been times when the temperature has just dropped on an average just a couple of degrees over a long period of time, we enter into a more frigid time in the history of the world. Scientists speculate on ice ages and things like that, but they don't have to speculate about what historically is true, like during the beginning of the last millennium, right shortly after AD 1000, the Earth moved into one of those cooler stages. And while they didn't have huge ice sheets covering much of the surface of the Earth like they speculate, nevertheless, mankind went through a terrible time for several centuries until gradually the temperature rose just a couple of degrees and things settled back down again. The weather was different. The ability to raise crops was different. That's called the argument from design as to purpose. And perhaps we'll talk about that only a little bit next time. To see that this argument from design has great power to be persuasive, we don't have to look at Anthony Flew and him saying that he came to believe in an intelligent designer because of it. We have to look at the number one New York Times bestseller in nonfiction right now. It's a book called The Grand Design by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow. Stephen Hawking is this highly recognized and praised astrophysicist in England who has this severe disease that has confined him first to a wheelchair, and now he's unable to speak with his own natural voice or do much of anything other than just maybe lift a finger and so forth, and yet by the accommodation of computers and other things, he still is able to communicate using a mechanical or electronic voice and to write and so forth. And he has come out with a new book called The Grand Design. And you'd think, oh, wow, he believes in a designer also. Absolutely not. The Grand Design is actually sarcasm on his part. But rather than stooping just to ridicule those who do believe in a grand designer, he attempts in this book, with the help of the other author, to try to give science's best answer to why it looks like there's design when there isn't. That's the true object of the book. And yet he's actually flying in the face of most of his fellow scientists by even arguing that there isn't design. Here is the description of the book, which I believe comes off the back cover. When and how did the universe begin? Why are we here? What is the nature of reality? Is the apparent grand design of our universe evidence of a benevolent creator who set things in motion? Or does science offer another explanation? In this startling and lavishly illustrated book, Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow present the most recent scientific thinking about these and other abiding mysteries of the universe in non-technical language marked by brilliance and simplicity. According to quantum theory, now this is all right on the back of the book, as I say. According to quantum theory, the cosmos does not have just a single existence or history. The authors explain that we ourselves are the product of quantum fluctuations in the early universe. Now you know, you're the result of a quantum fluctuation. And they show how quantum theory predicts the multiverse, the idea that ours is just one of many universes that appeared spontaneously out of nothing, each with different laws of nature. They conclude with a riveting assessment of M-theory, an explanation of the laws governing our universe that is currently the only viable candidate for a theory of everything. The unified theory that Einstein was looking for, which if confirmed would represent the ultimate triumph of human reason. Well, first of all, you know, I notice that it says they're trying to provide another explanation other than that there's a creator. Secondly, I noticed that they wanted to write it in non-technical language marked by brilliance and simplicity. They feel the need to try to persuade people that belief in God is not necessary. In fact, is unscientific. Thirdly, they present the idea that science offers another explanation. In fact, goes on to say that it's the only viable candidate for a theory of everything. Now, when they say only viable candidate, they mean the only viable scientific candidate. The other viable candidate is that there is an intelligent designer called God. But in science, they're trying to argue that those scientists who believe in an intelligent designer are off base and that they're unscientific. But you no doubt heard, because I did lay some emphasis on it, that they say that our universe is one of just many, they speculate, they theorize, that appeared spontaneously out of nothing. That's what they're left with when they have no creator. And they say that if it's confirmed, and again, that is their way of acknowledging this is a theory in the loosest sense of that word, if confirmed, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason. They didn't say human science, they didn't say evidence, they said reason. They're admitting that what they're talking about lies in the area of what we think, not in the area of what can be proven in a laboratory. It is kind of interesting that they bring up Einstein's name in all of this, saying that Einstein was looking for such a reason. What they didn't say is what Einstein's conclusion already was. This is what Einstein said. We are in the position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many different languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It does not know how. It does not understand the languages in which they are written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangements of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That seems to me is the attitude of even the most intelligent being toward God. We see a universe marvelously arranged and obeying certain laws, but only dimly understand those laws. Our limited minds cannot grasp the mysterious force that moves the constellations. By no stretch of the imagination was Einstein a Christian, but he, like Anthony Flew, came to believe that design meant there was a grand designer. And while these fellows say that they want to finally answer Einstein's challenge to find what's the underlying theory that explains it all, Einstein already had his explanation, that the proper explanation is that God did it. Innately, it seems, we all understand that when we see evidence of design, that there must be some designer in some form or another. And this has long been the point of contact between the atheistic scientific community, and more than the scientific community, of course, but especially the scientific community and the believers' community, is, well, you see design and say there must have been a designer, and we see what we may call design, but we don't feel like that requires a designer to explain it. Which is kind of strange, because in every other aspect of their work, they always believe there has to be a designer behind the design. But when it comes to the ultimate, they suddenly back out. And so we have this quotation from a prominent geneticist from Harvard, Richard Lewontin, who also is a well-recognized atheist. And he says, "We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, the materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." I like some of his statements that he's admitting about their own point of view. The patent absurdity, the counterintuitiveness of it. In other words, it's contrary to what common sense would tell you. The mystified nature of it. In other words, they have no explanation of why it is that way. And he says that it's not because what we have discovered has led us to that. It is rather because we have already decided that it cannot be God. So we must find any other explanation, no matter how patently absurd, to explain it. And he's still an atheist. Where's intellectual honesty in all of this? Well, that was being intellectually honest, but where's the point of following the evidence wherever it leads you? In more recent time, and starting in the 1990s, there began a movement within the scientific community among the atheists that has come to be called the Intelligent Design Movement. This, no doubt, is a part of what 10 years later Anthony Flew was also seeing and came to believe in an intelligent designer, because of what these other men 10 years before him were already seeing. As with greater scientific methods and so forth, they've been able to drill down ever deeper into the atom and into the very basics of life itself and how it all works. These scientists are saying, no matter how deep we go, we keep thinking we're finally going to get down to the primary elements, the simple things, the proton and the electron and the neutron in the atom. But instead, we find that no matter how deep we go and how many layers of, so to speak, of the onion we peel away, there's still more complexity and more minute components that make that up. At every level, from the very lowest to the very highest, we see they all work together, and there is every indication that this is some kind of masterfully, intelligently designed system we're a part of. And so biochemist Michael Behe wrote a book that talked about the irreducible complexity. I mean, that's not a word or a phrase I use all the time. The irreducible complexity of everything around us. And he says that put the lie And this is by a man himself who isn't any great believer. This puts the lie to the whole idea that this is random, that this is as a result simply of evolution, either at the biological level or at the astrophysical level or at the atomic level or any other kind of level. But instead, it is a carefully, fully, wholly, completely designed system. And you can never point to any one thing that somehow must have evolved to make this happen. But it had to have already been that way from the beginning, which is not allowed by the Big Bang Theory or the idea even put forth by Hawking and others that it came out of nothing. Unless it came out of nothing fully designed and functional and operational, which is what they have to say. And they have no explanation of how that could have happened. So many examples of that, and we'll touch on it in future lessons as we talk about the argument from life itself, the nature of the human cell or the cell in any living creature, and how incredibly complex it is, and how unless it was as complex as it is, it would not function. And when they even go to the most primitive, simple cells they can find of any living creature on earth, it is still infinitely more complex and organized and arranged and designed than anything we could ever imagine. And it would not work unless it were that way. There's no way that evolution can explain how it just worked from the beginning. They have to have it start out with just some juices and some mud and electrical impulses, and somehow gradually over millions, billions of years, it turned into these simple cells. But there's nothing in the study of the cell itself that shows that could have possibly happened. It's taken great faith on the part of those who believe such things. Greater faith, I would suggest, than it takes to believe in an intelligent designer who made it all. In Genesis chapter 1, the Bible begins by telling us that our universe has both a creator and a designer. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. We're having the two processes that were involved, creation and design, taking place at the very beginning. It was by intelligence. It was by design. Another evidence, for some, the greatest evidence, that an intelligent, all-powerful, eternal being exists. And as for the arguments by the Stephen Hawkings, the Richard Dawkins, and the others, 10 years from now, they'll have another theory. They will have discarded the one they have now, for it didn't work. It didn't fit the facts. It didn't persuade their colleagues. And most of all, it didn't defeat belief in God. So 10 years from now, they'll have a different theory. They'll be floating out there and want everybody to believe it as if it's more believable than the one we've been believing all the time. It's so amazing to me that science will put forth these ideas and say, finally, we have the explanation to everything. And you really ought to believe this because it's scientific instead of your old style religion. And yet 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now, you'd be hard-pressed to find any scientist himself who believed it. Because by then they will have moved on to something else as an explanation. Reminds me of the poem you've no doubt heard, written 100 years or so ago now, called The Hammer and the Anvil, written by John Clifford. It says, "Last eve I passed beside a blacksmith's door and heard the anvil ring the vesper chime. When looking in, I saw up on the floor old hammers worn with beating years of time. 'How many anvils have you had,' said I, 'to wear and batter all those hammers so?' 'Just one,' said he, then said with twinkling eye, 'The anvil wears the hammers out, you know.' And so I thought, the anvil of God's word, for ages skeptics' blows have beat upon. Yet though the noise of falling blows was heard, the anvil is unharmed, but the hammer's gone." That's what we continue to see happening.